heard. Ron's got the tape on. Morning, everybody. We don't have a bill jacketed yet. The revisor's office is doing that. But we're going to have the departments discuss their portions of the governor's supplemental budget. Commissioner Brenner, would you like to be first?
Morning.
Where's the articles in it? Welcome to our committee.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Scott Brenner. I'm the commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry. We come before you this morning with two supplemental budget items. They both originate themselves out of the Drive to Excellence program that I believe this committee, as well as others, have been versed on over the course of the last 12 months or so. One pertains to code consolidation, and I'm going to have my Chief Financial Officer, Cindy Farrell, work through that in greater detail for you. The other one is a one-stop licensing initiative that is broad-based in context. Mr. Chair, do you care which one we start with?
No.
All right. Well, since I'm already on a roll here, why don't we start with the one-stop licensing project? This is a project, again, envisioned by the Drive to Excellence proposal. Currently, we're working, some of you folks may recognize, each agency works through distinctive licensing approaches. We have 40 state agencies currently operating under some type of licensing parameters. We have 800 state employees working through licensing processes using over 60 licensing systems. And this project envisions an amalgamation and integration, creation of a new front end as well as a back end system for processing licenses. We're going to begin on the business and professional side of the licensing program areas, and once that's completed, we'll move into the recreational licenses as well. This request, I believe, is a $2.3 million request, which will allow us to blueprint and design and provide some architectural as well as some security standards as well as some finance standards for moving forward with the broad-based program area. We're looking at some other states that have been leaders in this, primarily the state of Texas as well as the state of Florida, who have been successful in this model. We believe it would be a much, much easier process for Minnesota citizens to work through their licensing needs. So in a nutshell, that's what the system's envisioning. We have, as of December, created a kind of front-end user interface function where we've created a website that has amalgamated in some kind of superficial sense licensing interaction, which allows citizens to work through the system a little easier, but there has been no back-end integration at this point in time. So that's what this money is designed to do.
You want to explain the governor's drive to excellence a little bit?
There might be
somebody that really doesn't know what's from up.
Sure, Mr. Chair. The Drive to Excellence initiative, I guess originally was announced back in, I guess it was August of 2005. The state contracted with Deloitte and Touche. A steering committee was assigned. I was actually chair of that steering committee. The steering committee was comprised of 9 state commissioners. We ran actually kind of 2 functions during that early period during the fall of 2005. One was a business process review to determine how the executive branch processes information. And secondly, we did an IT scan to kind of determine, frankly, what we had. We hadn't done, as far as I know, the executive branch hadn't done an amalgamated exercise like that ever. And so although independent state agencies knew what they had, the executive branch as a whole didn't know what we had. So that function, those two functions took place in the fall of 05. At the same time, we were working with both top-end management, commissioners, assistant commissioners, deputy commissioners, those folks, as well as line employees. A great deal of work was done with line employees. And through that process, we generated, I think, thinking back now, about 250 to 300 concepts that we thought may materialize into some type of business plan that could lead to one of two things: greater constituent value and greater efficiency within the executive branch. Those ideas were later digested through a ripening process and ultimately resulted in 26 business cases that were announced, I think it was around March, about a year ago this time. Of those 26 business cases, six of them were phased one that we had decided we'd go with initially. Two of those six I'm in charge of, and those are the two that you're seeing here before you today, one-stop licensing being one of those, and code consolidation being the other one. So that's what Drive to Excellence was in a nutshell. That's what one-stop licensing was in a nutshell, or what it is in a nutshell. With respect to code consolidation, we can move right into that if you're ready, and then I'm willing to take questions on any or all of it.
Do we have any questions on the code consolidation part so far?
So one-stop licensing piece, probably.
One-stop licensing.
Mr. Chair and Representative Mahoner, the one-stop licensing now, that has nothing to do with code or code enforcement. And primarily, my question is that are we going towards a state building code and enforcing that on all cities, or this licensing is just if you're coming for a plumbing license or a pipe fitting license? I was actually reading your 160-page bill yesterday, and I didn't realize you licensed some of those people. So,
Mr. Mayor, Representative Mahoney, the one-stop licensing concept isn't substantive in that respect. It has nothing to do with the alteration of the subject matter associated with existing licenses. It's purely the processing aspect of it.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mahoney.
And just so that I understand it correctly, this is a request for $300,000 in 06 and the 07, 08, and 09 years that are laid out there. But to start the planning process, to find out what may or may not work, and this committee or some form of it over in the next biennium will, you'll come back with what your ideas are. That would be a yes for the record.
Yes.
And then, Mr. Chair, Commissioner Brenner, who do you envision sitting on this planning? And maybe I just wasn't paying attention. Maybe I was reading this interesting note from veterans when you spoke to it, but who do you envision to be on this planning committee?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, we currently have a steering committee that's comprised of, I may need some help from the back of the room, but we have about 9 or 10 state agencies, the heavy licensing entities, and these aren't just the large state agencies. We have the nursing board on there, for example, as well. But the steering committee currently comprises itself of those entities that do the vast majority of the licensing for the state of Minnesota.
Any other questions? Proceed, Commissioner.
All right. With respect to code consolidation, and I'll let Cindy run into the details, but let me kind of provide a conceptual framework of what that issue is all about. Prior to, again, the Drive to Excellence initiative and the governor's executive orders that were promulgated last April, code within the state of Minnesota was very disparate in the way it was handled through the executive branch. There were, I don't know, 5 to 6 state agencies involved in code. So if you were in the process of constructing a facility, you literally had to interact with 5 or 6 state agencies to simply run through the code process. And so the concept here was to integrate all of that activity into a one-stop shop environment. That one-stop shop environment now resides at the Department of Labor and Industry. So we took into the department over the course of the summer and the fall the plumbing unit, which currently resided at the Department of Health. We took the building code unit, which currently resided at the Department of Administration. We took the elevator unit that currently resided, formerly resided at the Department of Administration. We took the Board of Electricity, which was a standalone shop. We took the residential contracting unit from the Department of Commerce. We already had the high-pressure piping unit, as well as the boiler unit at the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry. And we also took the code function, not the staff, but the code function from the fire marshal's office. So now all of code has been brought into the Department of Labor and Industry. We have, over the course of the summer and fall, integrated all of that activity. We've reorganized all that activity. We've broken it down, as opposed from a disciplinary approach. We've broken it all down into function, just like you'd see in a corporate structure. We've broken it down into 6 functional areas: code, enforcement, business plan review. And we've integrated all that activity to make it much easier from the user end to interact with the state of Minnesota when it comes to code. What you're seeing before you in this committee is an attempt to also integrate that funding activity. That funding activity, as you can imagine, when you're bringing in 6 different groups of people, they were some degree funded differently. And we're proposing that we standardize and integrate that funding activity, that financing, into one construction fund. This is all fee revenue. We suggest that fee revenue be used by those people that are being assessed the fee. And that's what this proposal is all about. There's a one-time surplus money of 1.7 that you're seeing in this committee. We're suggesting that we use that to create one integrated IT system. Right now we're working off 6, some of which are pretty poor, frankly. And we also suggest writing into law a requirement that we, the Department of Labor and Industry, do a fee assessment over the course of the summer and fall, reporting back to you folks, the legislature, next session, with a recommendation to fees. And if we're finding we're over-collecting, then we're going to come back and suggest that we decrease fees. That's what this supplemental budget item is about.
Any questions?
Cindy can go in much greater detail if you need it.
Go into more detail?
Yes, I do have a few comments, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Cindy Farrell. I'm the Chief Financial Officer for the Department of Labor and Industry. There's really 4 elements to the governor's supplemental budget request. The first is the creation of a new dedicated construction code fund. The operating expenditures and related revenue from the 5 different code units will be consolidated into this new fund. Currently, the units are funded as follows. The boiler and high-pressure piping and residential contractor and remodeler units are each funded out of the general fund. The electrical, building codes and standards, and plumbing and engineering units are funded out of a special revenue fund. The total expenditures from this new fund will be approximately $23 million per year. The second element is recognizing the hole that this will create in the general fund. The 2 units that are currently general fund, boiler and high-pressure piping and residential contracting, currently operate at a surplus. They generate more revenue than what has been appropriated for operating costs. Removing these activities from the general fund will leave a gap or a hole of approximately $1.7 million each year. The governor's budget proposes using general forecast revenues to fill this hole. The third element to this request is related to technology. As we go through and re-engineer our business practices, our technology must also change to support the new integrated processes. Currently, the five consolidated entities operate with very different computer applications and technological platforms with varying degrees of sophistication. We intend to use the surplus revenue from those two general fund activities in addition to approximately $850,000 of an accumulated surplus in the plumbing units account to upgrade and integrate these various applications. The fourth and final element of this request is related to penalties. We are requesting that penalties assessed by the new Construction Codes and Licensing Division be dedicated to the assigned risk safety account in the Workers' Compensation Fund, similar to how we treat other penalties assessed by workers' compensation. This account provides funding for safety programs, including safety consultants in the workplace services, the Workplace Safety Consultation Unit. The construction code penalty revenue would be directed towards providing safety consultations to the construction industry. And those are the four pieces of our request.
Very well. Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This doesn't have to do with the construction code consolidation, but so if anybody else wants to ask a question about that, it does have to do with some other oversight work by the Department of Labor, and maybe I could ask the Commissioner a couple questions about that. Just based on the last comment, it sounds like the workplace safety consultation is limited to the construction industry, is it, or will it go to can OSHA, will OSHA be in, within your department, will they be getting some of that funding?
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark.
Commissioner.
Yeah. Where that money is, as you, I think, are aware, our OSHA unit is bifurcated. We have an OSHA compliance unit, and we have an OSHA consultation unit. The OSHA consultation unit is the voluntary arm of OSHA. Businesses call on us to go in and provide safety audits. I'm trying to expand some of that program area on the OSHA consultation side into the world of construction. And this penalty money that Cindy spoke of would be used to fund that component. So it would be part of OSHA, be part of the OSHA consultation arm, the voluntary arm of OSHA, and it would be used to create a new construction program within that unit.
Maybe the commissioners I met with your OSHA folks last week. Are you familiar with that meeting?
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, I'm not aware of a meeting with yourself and the OSHA folks.
Have some pretty serious concerns about perhaps it has something even to do with your structure, the separation between compliance and
consultation.
Mr. Chairman, maybe what I'd like to do is maybe ask the Commissioner to come back another time when he's informed of the concerns around some OSHA issues. I mean, the problem is I'm not sure if you have adequate funding in your OSHA department right now, and perhaps that's where some of the supplementary budget should be going, because there's something terribly, terribly wrong with what's going on with OSHA inspections right now. And it's something this committee has talked about before. I've just recently met with folks from your OSHA department to talk with you about a very, very serious issue, which I've not heard back from anybody since last, I guess it was late in the week, so maybe I'll be hearing today. But part of my question is, do you have adequate resources in OSHA? And we may want to talk about where some of these, the supplemental budget should be directed or redirected or, you know, enlarged. And I guess I'll just leave it at that, Mr. Chairman. I'm very, very, very concerned, and I hope that your department is too.
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, I've done all I can with OSHA. I've actually been a big supporter of OSHA through my career at the department. OSHA compliance is funded through a federal work comp formula. OSHA consultation, I have to be honest, there's a greater demand for that service than what we could provide from a funding perspective at this point in time. But as I indicated, that's where this money is targeted to go to.
Okay, we'll discuss that at your request later.
Okay.
Representative Nelson?
I guess, Commissioner, I didn't hear you. Did I hear you correctly that currently you're saying there is not a consultation, or am I just confusing a program that I know that's out there?
But, Commissioner,
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, let me try to be clear on this. There are two arms of OSHA. There's the OSHA compliance unit, which is a traditional unit I think everybody at this table is probably aware of. There's also the OSHA consultation unit, the voluntary arm of OSHA. We do run two program areas. The consultation arm is the arm where, again, businesses call upon us, go out, provide safety audits. Should you correct what we find is problematic, there's no penalties associated with the program. What I'm trying to do, we have specialized programs generally in the world of manufacturing that provide high-level safety audits. We call them our MnSTAR and MnSHAR programs. What I'm trying to do, and we would become a national front runner in this area, is expand those program areas on the consultation side to the world of construction, where we currently don't have a MnSTAR, MnSHAR program in the world of construction. So what I'm trying to do with this penalty, the penalty dollars associated in the construction code world, is to flow those penalty dollars into OSHA consultation to develop that construction program. I am of the philosophical belief that penalty dollars shouldn't be spent in the program area where they derive themselves. I think it can provide some perverse incentives if given the opportunity. So I like driving penalty dollars outside of that program area into another one. Because OSHA consultation has more demand than what I can supply currently, this will provide some needed relief and I think provide a good service on the construction side.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson.
So you're talking about, because I'm aware of an existing program that I've been told is called an OSHA consultation where they go do safety walkthroughs.
Right.
You're just talking about expanding that into and the other program that the state has for businesses. You're talking about expanding that program into construction.
Yes.
Thank you. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, it's a question for the chair. I'm looking at this thing here, and it's all zeros in 06. So, as I'm looking at it, there's no expenditures in 06 that's being added or being subtracted or anything else. Is that correct?
I think what we're talking about passing here will affect at first 07, fiscal year 07, which starts July 1st of 06. So the things that are funded today are probably not included in this proposal because it's the product of last session number four.
And Mr. Chair, are we going to get, is this going to come in bill form?
Yes, it will. Right now, the part that wasn't available to us, I believe, was the human services portion, and that's why we have to use these the documents that we're using this morning. But we will have a bill that has to be passed or failed, one or the other. I guess that's our two options.
We could pass it without recommendation.
We could. But anyway, I did that first kind of sort of apologize for that because we don't have the documents in front of us.
Well, then, Mr. Chair, when this bill comes out, because several lines on a 8.5 by 11 really doesn't give us the sense of, it gives us a sense of what you're trying to do, but it's a bit harder to follow. And I know we all read these bills carefully, and we all come up with questions once we've read the bills. So it might be advantageous to bring the commissioner back or at some later time when we've actually had a chance to take a look at the bill and see what the department is trying to do.
We certainly can do that.
And commissioner, I'm not...
This is basically an overview of the supplemental budget bill.
Thank you. And commissioner, I'm not entirely sure that I followed you real well on what you're trying to do. And I do have some concerns, but I'm sure your crack lobbyist will show up in my office with less hair, I mean, at some time in the near future, with a copy of this bill, and we'll sit down and go over it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, as you know me well, you're always welcome in my office, or you're always welcome across the street at Savoy's, and we can grab a little lunch.
Any other questions about the labor and industry portion of this supplemental bill? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. I think next we have Commissioner Scott Ledoux on the governor's recommendation to reinstate the boxing board. And I have a couple of my constituents are very, very anxious to have this happen. Welcome to our committee. Give your name for the record.
My name is Scott Ledoux, County Commissioner in Anoka, and very big fan of boxing. just to give you a little background, I've been involved in boxing for, this is my 40th year. Last fall I did my last boxing exhibition, and it was a great opportunity to box and retire and put the hang the gloves up, so to speak, and it was really fun. I have served on the Boxing Commission for 18 years when it was in play. I also served as chairman of the Boxing Commission for 3 years. I've been boxing since 1966, 36 amateur fights, 50 professional fights, 11 world champions. We've actually had the opportunity in Minnesota to have 2 world title fights here. I think that it was a great opportunity for me to fight Larry Holmes here and Mike Weaver, and I think that bodes well for our state, that we could bring a title fight here and draw enough people to make that happen, and I think it was pretty exciting. I've also worked as an analyst for ESPN for 5 years, doing the boxing commentary. Just giving you some background on me, it's not about me, it's about boxing, but I just give you an idea where I have been and what I've done. I think it's very important that we speak about this event and about the commission. We need to reinstate it. Minnesota has a long history of boxing. The local professional fighters should once again be able to have a chance to fight at home, enjoy their local support and fan base. We have world-recognized officials, Denny and Mark Nelson, who are from St. Paul, who have done over 100 world title fights. They have officiated as referees and judges. I think it's important that we let them work at home and also give them the opportunity to share their experience and abilities with other officials that we have in this state. We have many other good officials in this state to be involved in boxing. Currently, there are 42 other states that have commissions throughout the United States. And they use the American Boxing Commission rules and regulations to support those fights. Without a commission, there'll be no boxing in Minnesota for professionally. It's an opportunity for us to help the local fighters get a chance to fight at home and potentially to get some big fights here to also take in some revenue. We also have a world champion that lives here in Minnesota, Will Grigsby, and he has no opportunity to fight at home. He's always on the road. The thing that I have seen over the years since we disbanded the Boxing Commission is that we only have tough fan contests, which are one of the most dangerous and unregulated events. It is not a sport. Similar to chicken or dog fights is what it amounts to. What is next? Ultimate fighting? Death matches? I just don't understand why we would let the tough man contest go on and without some kind of regulation. Boxing needs this type of regulation because it is an individual sport, unlike team sports that have players and unions to protect the players' interests and health. Boxing does not have any governing body except the states that have commissions. My proposal seeks a commission of 5 and an executive director that oversees the working of the commission. I've recommended that no full-time staff is needed at this time and that office space is not mandatory. This will achieve the fiscal responsibility that is desired by everyone. My recommendation for commissioners is that three people from the boxing community should be appointed who are familiar with boxing and from the local boxing community. The remaining two seats should come from the outside boxing world. I recommend at least one be an attorney or a judge to help facilitate this. The executive director must operate autonomously. He cannot be appointed by the commission. The executive director, I strongly support the method of appointing for a chair, the executive director. There's a danger if the commission selects the director, there's a danger of position becoming a puppet situation. The director could be influenced by the commissioners and not perform his duties independently. As I served for 18 years previously on the commission, Jimmy O'Hara ran the commission without being influenced by the commission members. We functioned as we should have and protected the safety and health of the fighters and were ethical in our decisions. I will be happy to answer any questions at this time from the committee about the Boxing Commission.
Representative Westerberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I really have a comment more so than anything. This is an issue that Representative Slawik and I have been working on together with Commissioner Ledoux, and I just want to point out, members, that the Boxing Commission was let go, you know, in a cost-cutting measure here by the House. We were looking at, you know, savings at that time, and we felt that the boxing matches would be adequately met through the National Federation of Boxing or the American Boxing Council. But since that time, they have decided not to allow that to happen, and they're requiring local control there as far as for liability reasons in order to sanction these events in our state. Also, Representative Bud Norness has got a boxer up in his district, and he's carrying one of these bills, too, just to kind of let you know why this is happening.
There's a thing that I comment on. That we, in the past, we had an opportunity that they were allowing an official from another state, another commissioner, to come in and run the boxing event. What happened was is that when he came in, he was a man for hire, and he was being paid by the promoter, not by the state. He was paid by the promoter, so there was a conflict of interest, one, and two, he was getting $1,500 to come in to do the fight. So his willingness to come in was also part of the fact he got $1,500 to come in. And along with that, there were some biased decisions, and we watched the fights. I mean, I remember going to a match in St. Paul when this guy was at, when these guys was in charge. They had a fighter on the card that was fighting another guy who had a record of 14 wins and 68 losses. And I think back to Jimmy O'Hara would have been spinning in his casket thinking about that, because it was just not right. And those are the things that the commission, local commissions, who are unbiased and unprejudiced and not paid off by the promoter, can take care of and able to do it ethically. And that's the thing about the game. I've been involved with it for 40 years. I've loved the game. It's been we've had great events in Minnesota, world title fights, and we've drawn lots of people and lots of interest. We have a great amateur program that feeds the professional program here, and it's just an awesome program. And it's an amateur program also takes care of the kids that cannot afford the hockey camps, the basketball camps. They come to our gyms, and we help them out, and we subsidize their opportunity to be involved in the sport. But I just think that I needed to point out that we had a fighter here that was 14 and 68 and was allowed to fight. I mean, that's just hideous.
Representative Clark, did you have a question?
I do. Let me just start with asking you. You mentioned the tough man fights. Are they legal in the state of Minnesota?
They're allowed. They've been allowed. And with the commission, there were not many of them going on because we were regulating and making sure that they had to do physicals and make sure they were healthy and that they had some sort of training of some sort, and they were not intoxicated when they climbed into the ring. All those events, we were overseeing that. And when that was disbanded, it was, now it's a runaway event.
Mr. Chair, the difference between a tough man fight and a boxing event that you would support, what are the difference, did you say?
Well, the difference is that in professional boxing, they come from the amateur ranks into the professional world, and they've been trained, they've been working in the gym, they work with trainers. Tough man contest says specifically that they cannot have a trainer, they cannot have any amateur background, they cannot have any experience in boxing, but they're allowed to go in there and just club each other and beat each other up. And there's no skill, there's no referee that was involved that's been trained, okay? There's no judging that is involved that's trained. In most cases, they don't have a doctor at ringside.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Clark.
Is the goal of the tough man the same as it is professional, which is to impair the other's brain by knocking him out?
In professional boxing, it is a sport where a knockout is one way of winning. However, a decision is the majority of the time done in boxing. It's not to impair the guy, it's to outbox him. It's no different than playing tennis. Love 15, love 30. You have skill in tennis where you have to use some talent and some strategy. There's also strategy in boxing and skills and talent.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm not saying there might not be some skills involved, but isn't the ultimate goal, the people that are most celebrated, I remember my grandfather watching boxing, the biggest deal was to knock somebody out. Which is what it does, and you know now, I'm speaking, Mr. Chairman, with some feeling about this, partly because, as a health professional, I know something about what happens to boxers' brains. We all should know from some of the movies that are out there now, but, there's long-term consequences to what's called a sport. And we may be able to dress it up and put some restrictions around it, and maybe even some skills and things to be admired about some of the opportunities in my brain for kids, especially since we've been cutting all the after-school programs. But I guess I really am wondering, we're still, I'm not sure why we would spend $50,000 to make something ethical, when perhaps what we should be doing is outlawing what's unethical and put law enforcement into that $50,000 into stopping the other sports that do not have any so-called sports that don't have any regulations around them. And so I'm just wondering, has there been an effort by folks such as yourself to try to, would you support efforts to ban the tough man boxing and the other maybe even more brutal sports in Minnesota?
I don't think tough man boxing belongs out there. It's a very dangerous sport,
mm-hmm.
and it's not unregulated and uncontrolled. Tough man is not a sport to me, and it's a ridiculous because no one's trained, no one's in shape, no one takes care of themselves. But I also I go along with what you say about there are injuries in boxing. Yes. There are also injuries in football. We have 17 men die a year in football. 17 a year. 6 a year die in boxing. So if we're going to start banning sports because people die, then the number one sport that's the most dangerous in the world should be banned, and that's fishing.
Mr. Chairman,
you want to ban that sport?
Mr. Chairman, I'm certainly not talking about banning non-contact sports, but I do have questions about contact sports whose purpose is to hurt the other person deliberately. Hurt them enough that they get points for it and then actually win a lot of money. And so I'm just talking about some concerns, and I find it as a nurse very hard to watch a football game. I keep thinking of what that rehabilitation is going to require for that, screwed up back or knee or neck or whatever. So I just want to say, I'm sure I'm in a minority here. Most people here may think boxing is a great sport. I just have some very big concerns, and I'm wondering, I guess I think I heard you say yes, you would support a legislation to ban or limit in some way the tough man boxing, if you will. I'll meet you right afterwards and we'll get that bill drafted because I think it should be outlawed.
Okay.
I totally agree with you. The tough man sport is not a sport. It's just a violent act, as far as I'm concerned. And along with ultimate fights, they should not be allowed in the state. I have had the opportunity. I was invited to Japan to referee ultimate fights, and it was the most violent thing I've ever done. And I have never, I just could not believe what ultimate fights, what they propose to each other. I mean, they're breaking bones, they're breaking, and they're choking people out. It's just amazing, and just that's where it's going to. And like I said in my comments earlier, what's next? Death matches? Boxing is a sport. Boxing is a skilled sport where young men are trained and taught how to box and how to use their skills. And if they take care of themselves and stay in physical shape, their opportunity for getting hurt is very minimal.
Representative Slowick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, Mr. LeDoux, I just want to make a comment along with Representative Westberg. We've met with you, of course, a couple of times. We've met the Attorney General is also very interested in this issue. And really, this bill is about, if we don't pass this bill, we're not going to be able to have boxing matches in Minnesota. The group, as Representative Westerberg said, that regulated this has said they won't now do it on an interstate basis, so we have to have this bill to keep it going. It is also self-sustaining, and it will pay for itself through the boxing fees. And also, isn't it true, Mr. LeDoux, that the tough man, the boxing commission will have purview over that, won't it?
Correct. We oversaw that in the past and made sure they had doctors there, made sure that they had physicals, made sure they were prepared to go into the ring, and made sure that that was the minimal amount we could do. Mm-hmm. But at least we could get that done. And now, since there's been no commission, no one has regulated it, no one has oversaw it, it's ridiculous.
Right. Mr. Chair, just a comment along those lines, so there would be more oversight, and then I think there's somewhere in Minnesota that there is an ordinance where it's not allowed, I think, right, in one of the cities.
There are cities that have ordinances that do not allow the tough man mm-hmm. boxing, and even there was an opportunity about a year and a half ago, we're up in New Brighton, they were allowing fights to happen in the street in a neighborhood. And they were letting, a parent was putting the fights on with high school kids fighting each other. I mean, just hideous. I mean, to me, I would like to have the opportunity to have that parent come in the ring with me and see how much he enjoyed that, being beat up like his young men were being beat up.
Mr. Chair, just the last comment. And we've also been working with the governor's office. So I think, you know, really there's been a lot of thought put into this, and I think it's something basically we have to do.
It's very important for the state of Minnesota to have a regulating body. You're going to have fighters, but they're not going to be able to chance to fight here locally. I'm sorry.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. LeDoux. I would like to make a comment to the idea of boxing as a violent sport. I have a large group of the young people in my district and live next to my district. There's a couple of gyms over there, and the changing attitude of these young men young women who have gone into the ring and been mentored by these men. I believe one of them is the next police officer. I might be wrong there. I want to say thank you to the boxing industry. They have really changed around the lives. And as you said, there's injuries in everything. And whether it's fishing or football or farming or whatever, we all wake up in the morning and take a risk. I applaud you for this particular effort, and I certainly hope we as a committee can continue this, because not so much for the professional, because it's become a bit more of a show than I care to enjoy, but having gone to some of the gyms and watching the young men work out and young women and see the changes in their lives, I want to applaud the boxing industry for that. So thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate that, Mr. Mahoney. The local amateur program has been around forever and has done a wonderful job. And the thing that we have to remember is that those amateurs go on to be professionals, and we need to have an opportunity for those young men that want to fight professionally to fight here at home and have their own fan base and have their friends and family see them box. We have some unbelievable fighters in the state right now. Jason Litzau is ranked in the top 20 in the world as a lightweight. I mean, just a tremendous fighter. Tony Von Sante is towards the end of his career, but still boxing. We've had a lot of good fighters in the last few years that have not had the opportunity to fight here. And I think it's important that we give them that opportunity.
Representative Park.
Final follow-up question, and partly from what Representative Slavik said, is it going to be the goal then of this commission to set limits and still allow tough man boxing, but with certain limits? Is that going to be your goal?
I think that in the past, what we've tried to do is make sure that the safety was the number one key. We wanted to make sure, one, that they had officials that were referees that knew what they were doing. At this point in time, there are bar owners that are getting in the ring and officiating these fights. We need boxing officials and referees who are trained to go in there and do their job and know that one guy is getting hurt. They need to stop the fight immediately. Safety has been the number one goal in boxing for the last 20 years. They've worked really hard at it and making sure that you've seen a lot of fights. They're not KOs anymore. They're TKOs, because the minute a guy gets hurt, that referee steps in and stops fights. And I think that's the most important thing that we have, is safety is first and foremost. In particular, with a tough man contest, without an official that has been trained and taught, we won't have any protection for those young men.
Mr. Representative, I still don't quite understand. You pointed out that you thought there was a big difference between tough man boxing and regular boxing.
Yes, because of training.
Because of training. But, so my question is, are you going to work with me to outlaw tough man boxing, or are you just going to put some regulations around it and still allow it? Is that what you're interested in doing?
Well, in the past, it was underneath the boxing commission, and officials were asked to go there and make sure that the fighters had a physical, made sure they were sober, made sure that they were protected by an official. That was all we could do.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I guess if we had a law that said it was illegal, we could do more, and we wouldn't even need to actually ask them. We could ask law enforcement to show up and stop it. So I'm just trying to get clear about whether or not you think there's a role or a place in Minnesota for so-called tough man boxing.
Not in my world.
All right.
Mr. Ledoux, I remember when the Board of Boxing was discontinued, one of the discussions was that most of the professional fights were in Indian casinos. What is your comment about that? Will the Board of Boxing have any oversight over those matches?
Well, what happens, we have worked, started in the past when we were coming to the end of that era, we were being allowed in to work with the commissions in the casinos, because boxing, where there is a boxing event held in a casino where there is no commission involved, those records are don't come forward. A guy could have a fight at the casino, but it doesn't go on his record. Without a commission, that's what the boxing world has done. They will not recognize a fight if it's at an Indian casino without a commission involved. And so that's what's going to help us a lot with the Indian casinos. If they want to hold fights and they have to have fights out there, they have to have a commission come in. And that's where we come into play. And that's what helps the fighters get it put on their record.
Thank you. Seeing no other comments, we appreciate your testimony here, and it's been very helpful.
Well, I really appreciate this opportunity. Thank you very much.
Next, we have the Minnesota Board of Architecture, Engineering, and Land Surveying, Landscape, Architecture, Geoscience, and Interior Design. Welcome to our committee.
Good morning. Ms. Frost. You left out one of my professions, and that is I'm now also the executive director of the Board of Accountancy.
Well, that's right. You guys were.
But I'm here.
It's not on your card.
It's on a separate card because there's egos involved in the two boards, as you can imagine. I wanted to do it both sides, but that didn't go over very well. But I am here to talk today about the Board of Architecture, Engineering, Land Surveying, Landscape Architecture, Geoscience, and Interior Design. And in the supplemental budget, I'm not asking for additional money. I'm actually asking that the $25 exam administration fee for monitoring the national exams be removed. And let me tell you why. currently all of the professions that I work with have national exams. Exam security has become a bigger and bigger issue. We currently administer only remaining the professional engineering, fundamentals of engineering, fundamentals of land surveying, fundamentals of geology, soil science, and then the professional levels for all of those exams. And we are in the process of outsourcing. Exam security has become a huge issue for us to regulate. But quite frankly, most of the national exams are going to sole source. The architects, the CPAs, the certified interior designers all have national exams that are computer-based, and we're in the process of outsourcing the engineering and land surveying. So the exam monitoring fee of $25, first of all, never covered our expenses, although it just went into effect in 1999, but we would like it removed from our statutory language. It's confusing to the candidates at this point as well.
Any questions? Representative Sir?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It says on our sheet here that this fee is currently a non-dedicated general fund receipt. Does that mean this fee does not go to the service that and to your individuals?
Representative and Mr. Chair, it is those all of our funds go back to the general fund and it's appropriated and back to us.
Okay. It'd just be fun that if we got rid of all the fees that didn't go to the service, we could be here for a long time. We could be here till December trying to figure out that.
There has been in history a lot of fees appropriate. I remember Cosmetology was their fee for licensure was, I think, accumulated to be $2.5 million for 1.5 inspectors. That one always got to me.
But then there's that certain cigarette fee, too.
I think we're going to find out what's going to happen with that. We might have some extra money spent. Anyway, thank you. Any other questions? Representative Slawick.
Mr. Chair, can you testify? You know, kind of a tough environment when everybody's going, fees are going on for everybody. So why should you receive special treatment? I mean, we have child care providers paying more. We have everybody having fees. The governor has fees on all kinds of things. So it's pretty hard for us to understand. I mean, it's money for that we need, right?
Ms. Ross.
Representative, Mr. Chair. That money won't be collected or charged because it's being outsourced. The fee is still collected for the exam administration, but it is going directly to the outsourced provider, the National Councils, for example. The exams still have to be given, and as a result, there's always been an exam cost in addition to the actual exam itself, but to monitor whether when you have a seat in a space to test. But we will not be collecting it as a state agency.
Privatizing or outsourcing it.
I see. So, Mr. Chair, so you're saying it's a collection issue?
Correct.
See any other questions? Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you,
Commerce Department. The Governmental Affairs Director, Mr. Sexton. Welcome to our committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. We had two items in the, Pat Sexton from the Department of Commerce. We have two items in the Governor's Supplemental Bill. The first is a MSHA assessment reduction, which is, I believe, $10 million a year in 07, 08, and 09 to reduce, bring some relief to small businesses. And the second is a MnDOT reimbursement. This actually doesn't deal, Ron's not here, in actual dollars. We reached a settlement with MnDOT on their claims to the Petro Fund. Instead of a bunch of, they had 200 claims to the Petro Fund, instead of spending a bunch of staff time and outsource, actually having to hire a person to fill out claims, we just decided to forego all the paperwork and come to a settlement of about $900,000 payable over 2 years. They were going to get the money anyway. This just allows them to get the money more quickly, more efficiently, and more cost-effectively. Representative Clark.
Good question. You referenced small businesses. The large health insurance companies are the ones who would not be paying the fees, and that's expected to be passed on automatically to small businesses? Is that your rationale, or is there something I'm missing?
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, a lot of large businesses are self-insured, so they don't pay the fee.
Mm-hmm. The health insurance agencies themselves, companies, are large businesses.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm just wondering the connection between... you're saying specifically you're going to reduce... This is targeted to... Is it $10 million? It's targeted to assist small businesses directly?
No, Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, not necessarily. It goes to pay down the premiums paid by MCHA. So it'll reduce the assessment increases for everybody through MCHA.
Okay, there's no special small business connection then.
No, sorry. I'm not a healthcare expert, not an MCHA expert, so I probably misconstrued it. Okay. So I apologize if I confused things.
Mr. Chairman, I'm always looking for help for small businesses. I represent a lot of them. I was hoping that there was a connection, but there's not. Okay. Do we know how much the premiums will be reduced, Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Sexton? Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, I don't know. You might have to talk to the folks at MCHA about that.
Is anybody here, Mr. Chairman, who can help us know that number?
So, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wilkin.
If I could take a crack at that for Representative Clark. When there's a shortfall in MCHA, which there always is because it's a subsidized mm-hmm. program, that automatically is assessed back onto all the health plans. That is a total pass-through to the small group market.
Mm-hmm.
So you never know exactly how much that's going to be, and I think there's two times during the year when that's assessed. There's one major assessment, and then they have kind of a catch-up for, and I'm not even sure when that happens. I think it's sometime in the fall, a catch-up for the remaining shortfall. But it is just assessed through, and it's the actual cost of the program.
Thank you, Representative Volkan. Mr. Sexton, any other comments?
Nope.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Sexton, can you tell the committee approximately how many people are going to be helped, or how many people are covered by MCHA? Are we talking 100 people or 10 million people?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, I bet Representative Bradley or Wilkin would know that number better than I. Representative Wilkin.
Are you opening yourself up for a crack here?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, I
think there's a law. Isn't there a law against lobbying for two? No, I am.
Don't hold me to this, but I thought the number was somewhere in the 30,000 range. That number sounds familiar to me, but I can't.
Is the recorder on?
Well, this doesn't necessarily, it might be driven a little bit by the number of people in MCHA. The people in MCHA aren't the beneficiaries of these particular dollars. These particular dollars are flowing through to the people who are subsidizing those who are on MCHA. The people on MCHA are already subsidized. This will lower the MCHA assessment that's assessed to those small group market purchasers. So if you got a small business in your district that, you know, small retail store that employs 15 people or something, that they have a small group policy, they're paying an MCHA assessment of a couple percent. This will lower that amount that they have to pay in to subsidize the MCHA pool.
Representative Clark?
It's still, maybe you have the answer to the question. I'd still like to know what we're talking about in terms of an actual reduction on the premium. What are we talking about? In some ballpark figure?
Wait, Representative Clark, I'm thinking that the total MCHA assessment, maybe Representative Bradley recalls the number that we just recently saw, is around $100 million. So $10 million might be, you know, with that would be a 10% reduction. But that number, it's been hard to nail down because right now Blue Cross Blue Shield, with some of their tobacco settlement money, has use some of that to buy down the MCHA assessment, so it's lower.
Representative Clark?
I wonder, I don't know if there's anybody in the audience. Is there someone we can maybe the witness, we could send you away with a request to come back with that information, if you would, that would be very helpful. I would just like to know what we're actually going to be able to say if we spend this $10 million, what is the average small business get for it? And I'm not still sure that there are other businesses as well. It doesn't depend on the size. If they happen not to be self-insured, I presume they will be assisted too. So I don't know how many. I'm just curious if we can get some estimate for small businesses and break it out, differences with those large businesses that are still under any self-insurance companies, and just, you know, I don't know, how much do we spend in administration, how much does the health insurance company get out of this as compared to the, to, you know, what we need to subsidize.
Mr. Sexton, is that information you can provide with Representative Clark?
I will, Mr. Chair, I will try to get it, yes.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wilkins.
Provide one clarification for Representative Clark. This MCHA assessment only goes on that small group market, the fully insured market. The self-insured market doesn't get assessed that. That's one of the disparities that drives us on the health committee nuts, that the small businesses who are least able to really afford it are assessed, and that's a shrinking market. So the assessments get bigger and bigger because it's a shrinking market, and they have to carry all the burden of that.
Representative Clark.
And Representative Wilkin, would you favor all business paying for MCHA, having an assessment for MCHA?
I can answer that for him.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark, actually, I'd love to see something where we could spread it out over a larger, larger base. The problem is that that is assessed directly on the policy, and we cannot do that on the self-insureds because they're governed under ERISA.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Clark.
Representative Wilkin, I bet you know a way around it, though, right? There is a way around it.
Well, I can tell you the way around it, Representative Clark, and it is not one that's going to be real popular out there. It would be actually increasing the health care, the provider tax. And that's the only one that hits all of those. You know, you might make an argument that reinsurance or stop loss for the big self-insureds, that can be assessed, but that doesn't assess the whole amount of health care costs with those self-insureds. So they still get a better deal.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, Mr. Sexton, are we taking money from the 2% provider tax that the state pays and everybody else pays, and then handing it over to this group? Is that where this money is coming from?
Mr. Sexton. Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, the money would come from the Healthcare Access Fund.
Okay, and where does that money come from?
That's it.
Right, correct.
That's the 2% provider tax, correct?
Correct.
You know, I'm asking the witness these questions. I don't need my colleagues to answer for the witness.
Again, I believe that's correct.
Okay, you believe that's correct. So we're taking that 2% from all of us that have health insurance and using that elsewhere.
Mr. Sexton.
Is that correct?
There's got to be somebody who knows more about this than me.
Well, then, Mr. Chair, I would ask that the Department of Commerce actually bring somebody to the table that can answer the questions. I actually like Mr. Sexton, and I've dealt with him a number of times, but the Department of Commerce can't come here and try to explain an issue and ask Representative Wilkins or Bradley or myself or Clark to answer these questions. I know you've done your homework in many other instances. This is a pretty specialized thing, and I don't think that it's appropriate for us to be asking questions across the table in this particular fashion. So I would ask that this particular part of the budget be laid on the table until Commerce comes with better answers or someone better prepared or people who actually run the MCHEC program. It's unfair to put you in a spot like this. You have to answer questions about healthcare, which is not your field. You need to bring somebody to the table who can.
Representative Wilkin.
Well, there's a motion on the table, Mr. Chair.
I don't think we have a motion before us, Representative Mahoney. There's no legislation.
Correct.
Representative Nelson.
I guess, Mr. Chair, that was my question that Representative Mahoney touched on it. The Health Care Access Fund is what funds NinCare. So we're taking, is that where this money's coming from?
Mr. Sexton? I believe that's correct.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair, so then we're using money from the Health Care Access Fund that has a surplus, and everybody likes to, or a lot of people like to deride it and call the sick tax and everything else. We're going to use that money to fund NinCare, which is a valuable program, I'm aware of what that does. So we're taking some of the surplus from NinCare, which would provide a subsidized health care for small businesses or people that can't get health care anywhere else, and funding NinCare.
Mr. Chair, that's the policy question before the legislative body. Again, the money would be given to Commerce as a pass-through. We're just a conduit.
Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Sexton. Next, we have the Department of Employment. No, we have the Department of Employment and Economic Development, the University Biotech Project. Thank you. Good morning. Welcome to our committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair, committee, my name is Gene Goddard. I'm the Bioscience Industry Specialist for the Department of Employment and Economic Development. There are two pieces as part of the governor's recommendations for the budget this supplemental budget this year related to bioscience. The first is the $500,000 for the BioBusiness Alliance of Minnesota. This is the former governor's bioscience council that we spun off to be run by the private sector in partnership with the University of Minnesota, the Mayo Clinic, and our department and other agencies and public institutions. Dale Wallstrom is here as chair of the BioBusiness Alliance to answer any questions or to provide additional testimony on that piece. The second part of the supplemental budget related to bioscience is the $18 million for the Mayo University Partnership. That is the second piece of funding. We did $15 million last year and $2 million the year before. And that funding is this year's funding is part of a 5-year, $70 million commitment that the governor has made to help fund bioscience research at the University of Minnesota Mayo Clinic as part of the partnership.
Welcome to our committee. Please state your name for the record.
Good morning. My name is Dale Wallstrom. I'm the chairman of the board for the BioBusiness Alliance of Minnesota. And I appreciate the time here this morning. Just real quickly, many of you probably have not heard of the BioBusiness Alliance before. What it is it's a nonprofit volunteer organization primarily. We're focused on, all of us are from, in fact, you have a packet coming around which has some information for you, and you notice at the back there's an organizational chart which will give you some idea of who's involved. So anyway, the Alliance is it's a group of people from the state government, local government, private industry, as well as the academic sector. We are a group of folks who have worked in the bioscience industry for many years in some aspect or another, myself with Medtronic. We have because of that relationship, we have experienced and witnessed what's happening to the global economy as a result of the rapid advancement of bioscience, both in the industrial agriculture, ag, bio, and also the human health sector. We would like to see Minnesota be out in front in the areas that we choose to be out in front in, so we have organized the alliance. The thing that we are primarily focused on, our primary outcome, is job creation. We have, if you have that packet in front of you, there's on the first page there is a triangle with a gold outer section. I'll just focus on it briefly. What we're attempting to do is to create a strong bioscience core, which in turn will help us to develop a strong biotechnology core. And then around the outside of that, in our definition of bio business, we include all of the other jobs that are associated with supporting the biosciences and biotechnology. And those are many in number. There's a pharmaceutical community up through the machinists and metallurgists and whatever what you may have. So this is what we are doing, the process that we are undertaking to try to establish both a vision for the state where we can go with bioscience and also a plan for execution, is we are implementing three strategic initiatives. And on page two of that document, there is a series of slides that I'll cover briefly. One of them is the very first thing we're undertaking is a statewide assessment. And the goal of the statewide assessment is to understand exactly where the state of Minnesota stands in our capabilities as it relates to bioscience from a knowledge generation perspective, and then also a commercialization point of view, both in the area of agrobio and human health technology. And that statewide assessment circle is identifies that. That assessment we started about 2 years ago, just about 2 years ago. The organization started 2 years ago. We started the assessment last year, and we are getting close to releasing those results. And it is, I would suggest that maybe at some point in time we may want to come back to this committee and give you the results of that assessment, because it is quite interesting. Second thing we're doing is we're beginning just now kicking off a what we call Bio Minnesota 2025, which is a 20-year visioning process to create a plan for to first identify where the industries will be in 20 years, and with 5, 10, 15-year interim steps to allow us to get there. And then the third is we are forming a Bio Business Resource Network, which is a group of people consisting primarily of volunteers, but also a core group of about 3 to 5 people this year that will be supporting industry, academic institutions and whatnot in the advancement of biosciences. And what we're asking for is the $500,000 for operational budgets. Our total budget is about $1.3 million for this coming year. The rest of it we will get from private donations. We also have about, so far to date, in the last 16 months, we've had about 60,000 volunteer hours, approximately, from primarily industry and the academic sector. And we intend to depend heavily on volunteerism, because we found that to be extremely advantageous. That being said, we do need operating funds, and we appreciate the opportunity to come in and talk about that.
Any questions for the testifier? Representative Slavik?
Mr. Chair, and to the testifier, last night I saw, is it Jennifer Kuzma from the University of Minnesota presented, and she urged us to ask questions, so I'm just going to ask you a question. Is when I see this, I see business represented here. I have three out of my district, and that's on here. Yeah. Are they paying dues to your organization, or how do they pay? And then also, if these folks are paying in, I don't see any legislative representation in this whole structure, or have you ever thought about involving a legislator?
Yes. In fact, we have this is not a membership organization, so there are no dues. This is a group of more of the scientific / business development people, such as Gene and others, from the state government. We also have local government people. We do not have legislators on at the moment. We are considering that as being one of the 17 activities that we would bring on board, yes. At the moment, we're focused very heavily on the science and the business side of it.
Mr. President, my question would be, if it's not dues paying, why do you need money from the state when private business looks like they could fund it?
Well, we think since we're creating jobs, it's not unreasonable to expect to ask the state for some support. And again, I want to be clear that we are not asking for all of it intentionally. We're trying to make sure that everybody who has an interest in this has a piece of skin in the game, so to speak. And that's where we're asking for donations from industry, we're asking for donations from the academic sector, and now we're asking for donations from the state as well.
Mr. Chair, what's the proportion of requests? Are you asking about the same amount from each? Or?
We're asking for $500,000 from the state. We're asking for our total budget for operating funds will be about $1.1 to $1.2 million. And then we will also ask for in-kind donation of time in the tune of about 10,000 hours this year, 10,000 to 15,000 hours. And those donated hours will come from industry and again, state people, as well as a lot of academic involvement, particularly U of M, Mayo, and Minsky are deeply involved in this.
Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, just a comment first. You know, the idea that you're creating jobs, I hope that we don't send a message out from this committee and from this legislature that any time a business creates a job, that entitles them to a state subsidy. Even if you match it a tiny bit more with private sector, and plenty of businesses out there who do not get any subsidy. In fact, the majority, especially small businesses, don't get any subsidy. They don't get a tax break. They don't get any of the special benefits that we've been providing to this bio business group. But I have a sort of question, which is a question I've asked a couple times now, and maybe you are prepared to answer or help find the answer, which is I would like to know in real dollars and cents numbers, and if not you, maybe the other witness or somebody in the audience, and I have requested, and I think I'm finally getting someone to come to my office to talk about this, but I would like to know what you can tell us about the return to the public for this investment beyond jobs, and I think that should be part of it. Mm-hmm. Definitely, it should be part of it. We should talk about what kind of jobs. So hopefully they're very good jobs. That's most of what we hear anyway. But what else? If we're investing in, whatever 3M product might be talked about here, or, cargo product, or, pharmaceuticals in particular, which I think are one of the areas I'd really like to know, since we invest a lot of money through this legislature in the research and development, and we're told by the pharmaceutical industry that the reason the prices are so high for drugs in our country as compared to other countries is because of research and development. I want to know what the actual reduction in cost is, if there is any, or are you even aiming for it? And I'd almost think we need a consumer person on your alliance here too, so that we can ask this question about consumer. What does the public get? What does the consumer in Minnesota get for, in this case, $500,000 investment? I'm talking about jobs. We want that, and we've heard a few assertions about that, and I hope they're true. Mm-hmm. But I want to know, in terms of the actual product, what kind of reduction can we get?
Testifier?
I don't think I can give you a crisp, clear answer, obviously, because you're asking a very complicated question, and one that will play out over time. What I can say is this, is that our goal is not to focus. By the way, I want to be clear that the members on this committee who are from industry are not representing our company. They're representing their private citizenship within the state. Now, and what we're doing now is true. We do believe, though, deeply, is that, like, as an example, my background, I was born and raised on a dairy farm in West Central Minnesota. And I went to school and I got a job working with Medtronic, and it's been fantastic for me, and it's done very, very well at a very personal level. Those of us who are involved with this, and what we will use the money for is to try to create capability within the state, within the educational system, first and foremost. That's why the academic sub-team, and that's where we're focusing first, is on education, understand what educational needs are to advance biosciences or biotechnology within the state. So education is an outcome of this. In fact, it will be the first outcome. That's why we have such an active team on that academic group. Along with that, of course, there do come jobs. And if you look at the data that's on page 2, I believe it is, of the handout, the average salary for jobs in this area are significantly higher. As a matter of fact, about $27,000 per year higher on average than they are in a typical job within the state. So we do believe that the quality of life, all the things that happen to your family and your kids and mine alike, are impacted by our ability to take advantage of this rapid growth in the area of bioscience, specifically in the area of ag, the ag community, and medical health, and the bioindustrial community.
Representative Mahoney?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the other committee members, I was on the predecessor to this with a couple of members from the House and a couple of members from the Senate, and then there was a variety of legislators that sat in on most of the meetings,
One thing I want, and I've heard Representative Clark's concerns, and she's brought it up a number of times, and the sad thing is that no one can stop in her office and give her a decent answer to that particular question. But I did want the committee and Representative Clark to understand that this may say bio-business, but bio-business is, there's a three- or four-legged stool to it, and the pharmaceutical end of it is only part. The ag part is huge. It really does make a difference out in our rural areas, and the business part of it is wide and varied and encompasses many, many things. excuse me. This $500,000 is minuscule compared to what other states are supporting their bio councils at. And it's been very frustrating for me, and I start to sound like a broken record around here. But when other states are pouring $500 million or $1 billion initiatives in, or in some cases $3 billion initiatives, and your organization comes and asks for $500,000, I certainly hope we as a committee can support that. I would ask that somebody, probably not your organization, the Bio Business Alliance, this might be a state function, to give us a better sense of what bio is. I mean, is it, you know, so we have some definitions of the bio business, the bio dairy, the bio medical, and variety of other things. Mm-hmm. And at some point, Mr. Goddard, it would be nice, one of the things that we've seen, and I'm sure all the many other committee members have seen it, we've seen bio coming through in damn near every committee. Mm-hmm. So it would be nice if they would all come through one committee, but if you could, sometime in the next week, since I have so much free time, I'm sure, come up with kind of some of those things, the definition, the parameters of what the business part, the ag part, and the medical part is for our committee, and to help Representative Clark further her inquiries.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative Mahoney, I'd be happy to provide that information for you.
Seeing no further questions, thank you, testifiers. Mr. Coleman, come on down. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Jerry Coleman. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Public Facilities Authority. Just when you're all thought you're done with wastewater in the Bonnie Village. Anyway, in the packet you'll find a little summary of what's in the governor's budget, supplemental budget, and then there's a little fact, or just a list. I'm good at lists when it comes to who's getting the money as far as the phosphorus grant program, but just some highlights. I know you don't have a bill in front of you, but what's in the bill. There is two new programs being established, and as part of the Clean Water Legacy issue, the component of that program that comes to the TFA is in this committee. There's a phosphorus reduction grant program. The governor's recommending $2 million to get that program started, and then the bill itself has the language creating that program. It is a starts out at a 75% grant program to encourage cities that need to reduce their phosphorus load or discharge up through the year 2010, and then it'll drop down to a 50% grant. So there's an incentive for cities to move ahead and proceed with that. There's a small community wastewater treatment program, which there'll be $1 million for. 100,000 of that we're requesting to be used for technical assistance in through the University of Minnesota Ag Extension to work with small communities. I don't know if the committee members, when I talked about the WIF program and some of the corrective action projects in there, and then last year's bonding bill, there was $5 million in that to fix systems that were poorly designed, poorly built, poorly operated, poorly maintained, just everything. And there were 8 more this year in the bonding bill. What we're wanting is the U of M, because they've got the expertise out there in the field, is work with those communities before they hire a consulting engineer so they know what questions to ask, look at options available. Engineers want to design big pipe systems. A lot of these small communities, it's just a matter of upgrading septics, or where septics won't work, maybe do some community mound systems, lower cost, lower tech. But they need that knowledge and need some of that technical help up front. So part of that small community program is provide that assistance up front, and the remaining is a 10-year loan at 1%, or if it's a low-income community, up to a 50% grant, and then a 1% loan to help property owners pay for septics or small effect solutions to their wastewater systems. And it's really to plug a gap. When we looked at the clean water legacy as a whole with multi-agencies and where current money is and what needs to be done, there was a lot of analytical work that needs to be done. And then there was kind of that gap between the municipal big pipe stuff that we've been doing for the last, state of Minnesota, 40 years through various programs, PFA since 1988. There seems to be a gap there in some of those small rural communities where there's a lot of direct pipes been discovered, failing septic systems, so we're trying to create a program there. The governor also recommended $1,310,000 is an odd number because that balanced out the Legacy Act to $20 million to put into the Water Pollution Control Revolving Fund. And if I remember, there's $32.8 million in the governor's supplemental budget for the Water Pollution Control Revolving Loan Fund and the bonding bill, I mean. And this is just additional money that will leverage in the marketplace with revenue bonds and fund more projects. But they felt it important to make sure people know there's some implementation money and it's not all studies being done as far as the legacy program. And as far as the bond, and there's also some technical amendments to a program that's passed last session in bonding bill, the total maximum daily load grants, which was in last year's capital budget bill, or there are just some technical minor changes we're adding to that and proper citations. And the last thing in the governor's supplemental budget is increase the Public Facilities Authority bonding authority. We're currently at $1.25 billion. And we're asking to increase that up to $1.5 billion. And we come into the legislature every 2-3 years, sometimes 4 years, depending on how much we bond, and increase that authority. And we're up at $1 million and just looking at trying to do two lists this coming fall and leverage a lot. Plus, by the time we get around to the next bonding bill, we won't have enough authority to cover the projects we intend to fund, assuming the governor's reps all get survive the legislature and we have the money to actually finance these projects. So we're asking for an increase in that as well. The program is AAA rated by all three rating agencies. It's just a tad better than the state of Minnesota's GL bonds, which is fairly consistent across the nation. The state revolving loan funds are highly rated, and in most states, if they're not AAA, rated there, they're usually tend to be a notch higher than the state's general obligation bond rates. That's primarily because these loans that go out are backed by general obligations of municipalities. There's usually a large pool of 200 plus or 400 borrowers, plus you have the state and federal funds that go in as equity into those to back the bonds and generate the subsidy. So all that makes for real good credit quality and allows a lot of state SRF programs to borrow money cheaper than almost any other entity in the state, whether it's general obligation bonds or revenue bonds, because we are good credits. So with that, I'll keep quiet and see if anybody has any questions.
Representative Ruth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Coleman, what is the definition of a small community? What's the population?
The ones we're looking at are with this program would be under 10,000 gallons a day flow. Anywhere from 20 to 30 homes, where you have, you know, small clusters in rural communities, under 100 population, we're looking at.
Seeing no other questions. Hey, who said you can't make wastewater treatment fun?
Oh,
right? Thank you very much. Next, we have the small business assistance fee. Representative Westerberg has informed me that he read the minutes from the Thursday, March 16th meeting, and he has a motion.
I'd like to move the minutes.
Any corrections or additions to the minutes? All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed? Motion passes. Welcome to our committee. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Chuck Hamilton. Some of you know me as the Director of State Services for the Blind within the Department of Employment and Economic Development. However, today I'm here wearing a different hat. I am working with Dee's housekeeping bill as it moves forward through the legislature, and a portion of that housekeeping bill is also in the governor's supplemental budget. It is some language that this committee is probably familiar with, in that you passed that language last year related to the Small Business Innovation Research Project. There was rider language that provided $100,000 per year in the base and did talk about some requirements for the department to set some fees. There was an understanding, a legislative intent, that these fees, which you'll see, in fact, this section is actually before you tomorrow morning via House File 3133, sponsored by Representative Gazelka, and it will be in bill form at that time. It has been through two other committees as well. The fiscal note talks about under $20,000 per year. The legislative intent was that the department keep those fees after the session in consultation with the Department of Finance, and after some letters from the chair here as well as in the Senate, it was determined that there was not statutory authority to follow through with legislative intent, and therefore this language was brought forward. Again, you've already passed it once. It makes it clear the legislative intent to maintain those fees within the department.
And let's talk to the author of that bill, because he must not have read it carefully. Oh, yeah, that was me. That's right. Any other questions for the testifier?
How about for the chair? Was that a freshman mistake?
Maybe. Maybe just a mistake. Seeing no other questions, thank you very much. Human Services. Is Mr. Johnson here? For those in the audience, in case we're not able to finish today, in that event, we will make sure to review the materials we missed when we are actually have the legislation before us. So welcome to our committee, and please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, I'm Chuck Johnson with the Department of Human Services. There are five budget pages that relate to the Department of Human Services that should be in your packet. I'm not sure how you're organized. The first one that I have is page 50 that's entitled Federal Deficit Reduction Act Requirement for Mandatory $25 Federal Child Support Enforcement Collection Fee. So if you get yourself to that page, that's the first page I'll talk about. This addresses an item that we mentioned last week when we presented on the Deficit Reduction Act, the requirement for a $25 fee within the child support program. The federal law requires this fee to be implemented 10-1 of 06 this year. And it's a $25 fee that's applied to families that have never been on public assistance and only when there's $500 of collection made in a given year. So it's only for a certain set of families and only after we collect at least $500. Our proposal would apply this fee to the custodial parent, meaning it would come from the payment that is made on behalf, that is made by the non-custodial parent. The fee, once fully implemented, would collect about $1 million a year, $750,000 in 07, because it would only be a portion of the year. By federal law, two-thirds of that fee, the revenue from that fee, would go to the federal government. The other third would be retained by the state. Governor proposes that those dollars be distributed to the counties, which is how we distribute revenue from other fees within the child support system. Goes to the counties through what are called incentive grants to support their infrastructure for enforcing child support at the local level. One item that is not identified in this page but will come before the committee probably as an amendment to the bill when it's here. We were involved in a meeting with the federal government last week to understand more about this fee. And from that meeting, now understand that the federal government is going to be issuing proposed regulations in September of 06 on this fee. And the fee is supposed to be implemented by October 1 of 06. At this point, we're hearing from the federal government they will not penalize states for not implementing by the 10-1-06 timeline that's in federal law and will give us more time to implement that fee. We are proposing to add some contingent language into the law that would allow us to delay implementation past 10-106 in the event that we do get additional guidance from the federal government that suggests that we need to change the way the fee should be implemented differently than what we're proposing this year. But we want to keep that 10-106 deadline or effective date in the law, in the state law, just in case the federal government changes the guidance sometime between now and October, that we are prepared to meet the deadline that's in federal law. And this is very compressed timing in the way things are working, but we think we need to have that flexibility as the federal government sort of unfolds the impact of this new federal law and we figure out what the impact will be.
Representative Slavik.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Johnson, so the $25 isn't an increase for a parent that's already paying, it's just less money the child gets.
Mr. Chair, Representative Slavik, that's correct. It will come out of the money that would otherwise go to the children, child or children.
Representative Clark.
And Mr. Chairman, this also has nothing to do with service provided, right? Because they may have never used assistance. In fact, it's for those who have not required the service before.
Mr. Representative Clark, never used assistance in the way that I used them, and never used public assistance. So that means a family who had never been on MPIP. These are families that did use the enforcement services within the child support system.
Representative Slavik.
Mr. Chair, just a question, and I know it's still unclear with the, what the feds are requiring, but is there a chance that you could just do an increased fee of $25 as opposed to taking the $25 from the child?
Mr. Chair, Representative Slavik, that is one of the reasons why we want to have the contingent language, is it is possible that the federal guidance that we'll get in proposed regs or otherwise would allow us other options for how to apply the fee rather than taking it from the payment that would go to the children. So that's one of the reasons we want to have that contingent, is to assess all the options before we make a decision for Minnesota.
Representative Mahoney.
So could you tell me, are these, is this $25 fee from the non-custodial parent, is there a reason that these non-custodial parents are in this particular pay system? In other words, is there a history of these non-custodial parents being late with support payments? Or is it just because the judge didn't trust the non-custodial parent to pay on time and he or she put them into this particular program?
Mr. Johnson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, it would occur because it was a part of a court order that the dollars be collected through the child support system, or because the custodial parent applied for services through the county for child support enforcement.
Representative Mahoney?
So there's no evidence that the non-custodial parent paying support, there's no benchmark that says this particular parent was late or had problems paying, it's just for the convenience of the court or the custodial parent?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, the court makes the order based and usually orders that the support be collected by the state and distributed by the central payment system for the child support office.
Representative Mahoney.
It's a court order.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, it would be my office gets flooded with calls for some about this particular program, and I would actually really like to know at some point, and maybe it's the courts I have to go to ask this, maybe you know, or could find out, how many of these parents are being ordered into this program for no other reason than just because the judge always orders them into this particular program. My guess is that in the end, we're going to take $25 from the child. We already take 1% from the child at this particular point with this fee. I try to read as much as I can, but I sometimes don't get it all done. So I'm kind of torn here because it just seems that we're throwing people into a system for the convenience of somebody that sits in a black robe and doesn't seem to hear
anything other than what they want to hear. So is there any way I can find out if these people have a history, that are in this program, have a history of non-payment of child support?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Mahoney, I'm not sure, but I can take that back, and we can see what we can analyze to get at the answer to your question, and meet with you to discuss that if that would be appropriate. I'm not sure exactly what kind of information we have that would bear on the question that you're asking.
Thank you.
Members, if we could have you take this packet and put it in your save folder, and we will, when we take up the actual legislation, we'll review the other four items at that time. Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Representative Gunther, anything else? Okay. With that, the committee will adjourn. Thank you.